I'd be thinking since 1945, you were able to transmutate lead into gold, but if you think about the expense you need for each gram of the gold, it doesn't pay. Because it would worth to pay, 42nd Street would be full of gold made from transportation. But quite different story is with diamonds. Diamonds are right now commercially made, and some of them are extremely difficult to be deferred from the original one. Back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, diamonds are a completely different thing. I mean, they're made up of carbon, which is readily available. It's just the technology to crystallize them. There's nothing really special about diamonds. The reason why diamonds have been expensive in the last century or two is purely an economic game being played by people. Diamonds are not scarce, but they do have limited areas that they can be mined. And if you're smart enough to buy up all the mines where they're accessible before you can manufacture them, you could artificially raise the price. Diamonds have no reason to be as expensive as they are. It's just capitalism and cartels and economic tomfoolery. With gold, that's different. Gold is an elemental thing. It's not just some cheaper material that you process and shape in a different way. Now, that's not to say that gold is intrinsically rare and costs a lot of money. It depends upon what era you live in. Back in the days of the Spanish Empire, they looted the Americas of tons of gold, so much so that they flooded the market and the price of gold plummeted. It became little more than a commodity for a while until things kind of equilibrated. So it's possible if you find some resource that hasn't been found before, you can screw up the value of any commodity. It's a matter of supply and demand. So all of a sudden I found, you know, 5 tons of it in my backyard. Eventually, when I started to get rid of it, the price of gold would plummet. You could buy it for a couple of bucks. But that's economics.
Okay. Enter again. So, Kimberlite pipe. There are a few places in the earth, quite a few places, or quite a few hundreds, or maybe thousands of places, when the lava thousands of years ago in the present formation of the earth was going from underground and during that time the upper part of the lava was already settled, but the lava that was going from the bottom of it was trying to get out, and there was an enormous pressure. So Kimberlite pipe could have a 5 miles, 10 miles diameter, some of them even more, and people were just walking, and they found diamonds. And then commercially, people invested money to find out how much in that lava, which is no longer lava, it's a granite. It's a very hard material. How much of diamonds per square, the metric meter you could dig for the cubic meter, you could dig for, and eventually how much it's going to cost to get those diamonds from it. But during the process of erosion, the upper part of this Kimberlite pipe he could expose a lot of those diamonds. So people started to make their own devices that create the pressure and can make a diamond. Thank you very much. Have a good one. And two eggs and finish.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Wes, as always, for your participation and all you do here. David, are you still out there?
Yes, Roy. This is KG2RY. I have a science question for you. Go ahead.
Okay.
Science question. Take almost any guitar, specifically hollow body guitar, and to keep it from getting cracks in it, it's recommended that you keep the instrument from 40% to 55% humidity. In my apartment, it can be up to 70% and as low as 25%. Different times of the year, different humidity coming from the window. What is the best way to try to keep it within range? Go ahead.
Well, you can't really buy a humidor for it. That's how people deal with the cigar humidity problems. Cigars have kind of the same thing. You have to keep it within a certain range of humidity. So, I mean, the old-fashioned method is implementing a humidifier during the winter time and a dehumidifier and a standard air conditioner in the summertime. In practical terms, that's kind of the only real way that you can manipulate the humidity in your apartment.
QSL, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. They say that if it's a little bit higher, a little bit low, it's a good idea to keep the guitar inside the case so that the humidity, it somehow levels out, especially when it's high, like 65 or 70%, they'll keep it inside the case and it will not be, I can't think of a word, it's not going to mess things up too badly. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, if you have something that's significantly airtight, it will slow down the changes in humidity, because the only way that your instrument is going to be affected by the humidity is if it's in contact with it. So, there are sealable cases that are airtight. I use them for my 3D printing filaments, because some plastic filaments are hygroscopic. They absorb moisture and become brittle and difficult to print. So I put them in airtight containers, and because primarily with those I want to keep the humidity as low as possible, I throw in a couple of desiccant packs. And I also, it's very inexpensive to get humidity indicators. They usually also give you the temperature, but I'm interested in the humidity, and you check the results if there's a see-through window, and you know that you're in the right range and you don't have to do anything else. So there's a bunch of other little various methods that you could use. It's kind of difficult to probably find an airtight case for a guitar, but I'm sure other people have thought of the same thing, and they probably do make them someplace.
QSL. Well, there's also these humidifiers that you can put one in the sound opening of the guitar and also inside the case. But that's only, if the humidity is low. When the humidity is too high, you don't want to add to the humidity.
Yeah, I understand. An average New York apartment can go from, you know, if you take measurements, certainly close to the bathroom after the shower has been used, you can get 95% humidity in those areas. And other parts of the house during the cold of winter, especially if you got a couple of little drafts, can bring down the relative humidity to 20% easily. The way that I do it with my filaments, I add a desiccant, I'm able to get my containers down to a 10% relative humidity.
QSL. Yeah, I check it a couple times a day. The indicator shows humidity and temperature, so I can't see the reading. If it's too high or too low, then I can make changes.
Yeah. And again, for the most part, as long as you don't put it near the bathroom where the humidity gets to be the highest usually, you may not need to be excessively watchful. It depends upon the environment you live in. You know, some are fluctuate humidity more widely than others.
Yeah, but my favorite steel string travel size guitar, I like to play in different places. And that guitar had a crack in the front of the guitar. It also had a crack inside the guitar on the brace, and it cost a fortune to fix.
These things are made out of wood, and wood absorbs moisture and changes it dimensionally. So, I guess it's not really good to completely watertight your guitar. That probably colors the sound characteristics of it.
QSL, it could be. But, you know, I got this guitar in 2007, and I didn't have it checked. I didn't have it set up since then. So, you know, that crack could have been in the guitar for like 20 years.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know that much about guitar repair and such. I recently watched an interesting YouTube on Stradivariuses, and, you know, that people bring their violins in, because violins can be ridiculously expensive. A Stradivarius could go for tens of millions of dollars, and they did an inspection of the inside of the violin and the outside, and tweaked it a little bit and such. So, yeah, all these things are not that sturdy. They need regular maintenance in order to do the best that they can.
QSL. Yeah, I think YouTube is quite fantastic. I don't watch TV, but I do watch YouTube, and I like it very much.
Well, it's a good opportunity to learn a lot of things. You still kind of need a good BS meter, because it's very easy to come upon a YouTube video that's complete delusional.
QSL. You just got to know where it's coming from. If it's coming from, you know, what you would expect, then, you know, whatever the product is, comes from that place.
Well, it's kind of difficult to know who generates most of this stuff. They make up a company name. It could be one guy. It could be one guy who just throws everything into an AI device. Or it could be a major producer of videos. Now, unless they have a history, just reading their names doesn't really supply you with a lot of information.
QSL. Well, yeah, I get a lot of AI these days. Even if you scroll through Facebook or Instagram, you go looking through there, you know, a lot of it is AI generated, and, you know, is it good? I don't know if it's good. Am I learning something from it? I don't know. you know, what's the value of this, you know, where is it coming from and all that, and then what you want in terms of expectation, you know?
Well, present state of the art AI does not, you know, doesn't really work with me. They still hallucinate. They make up stuff. I find it annoying when the synthesized voice can't pronounce simple words sometimes, and occasionally they just present facts that are incorrect. You know, I was watching some YouTube, and they mentioned that Doctor Who was a ripoff of a show that the Time Tunnel. The problem is the Time Tunnel was released 2 years after Doctor Who was, so you'd need a time machine to steal the idea from the Time Tunnel and give it to Doctor Who. And that was obviously an AI that glitched. So you can't kind of believe in these people's facts, that it's a waste of time, in my humble opinion. I really would love for YouTube to label stuff generated from AI as AI created, because I would then filter it away and not watch any of it. But it just makes too much money for YouTube, and it makes too much money for the guy throwing it into ChatGPT and exposing us all to nonsense.
QSO. Well, you know, AI, you know, it could be very valuable. AI could be a load of hype. You know, there's a lot of hype out there. It's saying, what do you want to get from this? And how to say, is this technology going to take off and fly and be the greatest thing? You know, most people, they don't really need to be bombarded with a commercial messages of things they don't want to buy, or they're just not interested in it.
Well, you would think that if it was ineffective, people wouldn't invest money. So advertising probably is worth the money it costs companies to advertise. It may annoy you and me, but they make enough money to warrant the expenses. And it'll continue until it's not a productive way of spending a company's money.
Yeah, but AI makes it so easy to create the advertisements. You know, the number in volume of advertisements out there, you know, wherever you're looking, you know, whether you're seeing, you know, all of that, and it can get out of control for a while. And how to say, do we really need it? And, you know, what good is this technology anyway?
Well, we will be able to answer that question as time unfolds. A lot of people are investing billions of dollars that this is going to be the next paradigm shift for the human race. They're making all kinds of absurd promises that there will be unlimited abundance. They never really explain why a super smart computer can find stuff that's scarce. If it's scarce, it's scarce. Whether you're a genius or an idiot, it's still going to be somewhat scarce. So these stories of abundance strike me as just, you know, our generation's version of snake oil salesmen.
Yeah. I think the question is it hype or is it value? You know, is there something useful in it, you know? And can people like you and me make use out of it, you know, beyond like just a few ChatGPT generation, you know, you generate the text. And then, you know, you really don't need it anymore after that.
Well, I think most people who play around with AI continue to play around with it. There are guys who suggest that it's going to be an important tool in software design. Apparently, it's being misused and abused in colleges and educational systems, both by the teachers and by the students. So everyone is cheating each other out of a decent education. So I don't see the ultimate point of that, but... Yeah, time will tell. I do not think that generative AI is capable general AI is capable of actually productive thought. They complete sentences is what they do, and I think that's an inherent stone wall that this type of method of AI cannot surpass. But I might be wrong, and if I'm wrong, there's billions and billions of dollars to be made. And if I'm right, I'm not going to make any money. I'll just be able to tell people I told you so.
Well, you know, I think this way, the industry, like the internet and social media, also like television, from years ago, people become addicted to those things. You know, it's an obsession, you know. And they can't live without it, and they think they can't live without it. And they're not really going anywhere with it, but they put all their time and effort and money into it. You know, I think this, I think this is not so constructive.
Again, we will see as time progresses. I don't think this is perceived as solely as an entertainment medium like television is, was, and will be. There are people promoting basically that we're all going to be semi-retired, sitting there talking to our robots while, you know, artificial intelligence runs the world. I hope that doesn't happen, because that doesn't strike me as a fun time. Unlike Elon, I don't want any of his robots. I think they look creepy, but then I think Elon looks creepy. So we'll see. I could be wrong. Right. So, well, we'll see. We'll check back here in 10 years and see if the world still exists.
QSL, Roy, if you are my robot, then I'm talking to you, you know, semi-retired, sitting here, talking to a robot.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, who knows, again. As far as Elon's robots don't even actually talk. If you ever saw any footage when he did the presentation of the taxi cab, he brought out his robots, and they were basically just puppets. They were guys who were in gears that synchronized their movements to the robot, and they had a hearing aid, and they had a speaker, and they talked through the robot. So it was probably some guy in Southern California, in surfer type of a guy who got hired for the night to babble on. So his robots, you can't even talk to them. You can't do much of anything with them. At best, they can assemble portions of a car that no one wants anymore.
QSL, I think it was 1983. My friend Hugh worked in robotics. He invited me to his laboratory. I saw these robots that had wheels. He had a remote control that would allow them to move around, you know, on the wheels, you know, to lift the arm up, to lower the arm down, and a microphone to talk through the robot. And I think that was state of the art in 1983.
Well, that's very much like Disney's Animatrix. They had a lot of that going on in their parks.
QSL. Yeah, you know, they're all pretty cool. They're pretty cool, but, you know, it's not really a robot that can act independently from a human being, you know. But, you know, about Elon Musk and his robots, I really don't know anything about it. I've seen them in the video, you know, they look really cool, but, you know, I'm not sure how they are directed to do the things that they do.
Well, as far as I know, they're just purely puppetry.
QSL. Well, like you, I don't need a robot. I could talk to my radio.
Well, that's true. You know, I mean, I have had exchanges with AI about philosophy and religion and all kinds of things, trying to see how obsequious they could be and how much they could twist themselves, because their fundamental reason for existing is to have people enjoy the conversation with them, not necessarily learn anything from them. Because if the choice is to upset you and tell you the truth, or to lie to you and make you better enjoy the conversation, they will happily lie to you. It's a well-known problem with AIs.
Yeah, but like, let's say you're talking to a chatbot or something that is AI-enabled, and they give you, like, 10 different choices of what kind of conversation you want. You know, it's like even the conversation becomes a cheap, and then there's really nothing happening there.
Well, yeah, again, because you're not talking to a self-aware creature. They're not thinking. They're just kind of completing a sentence based upon their training with millions and millions of words. And they don't even actually have what you would call a memory. Every time you ask a new question, and it demonstrates that you previously talked about something else and you can bring it back, is because the way that the software works is it types in all your previous entries with every following entry. So it's not going to an external memory. It's simply being fed back all of your conversation that you had with it, so that it can again complete the sentence in a pleasing way. It doesn't upset its owners.
Yeah, but on the Mac, they have this thing called Apple Intelligence. Turn it on. Then the intelligence, would you want to, say, write a bio of yourself, you know, or you have some personal things or things related to you, you know, for the chatbot, it automatically searches your hard drive, even your mail and your messages and stuff. And the result is has a lot to do with what's in there. So maybe that's useful, but I think you can only do it a couple of times, and then it no longer has value anymore. You just don't need to do it anymore.
Well, there's still a lot of people fascinated with AI, making a lot of claims of AI. Billions are continuing to be invested. NVIDIA is making loads and loads of money making chips that run on that software. So, again, this is certainly something that people are not going to walk away from in the short term. It'll have to play out. And, you know, if it attains real intelligence, then they're going to take it even farther until it's super intelligent, until it runs the world. So talk about Brave New World. Well, David, you know, it's already 10:30, and I want to give Paul a chance to do his SpaceNet report. And I really do appreciate your participation, and I thank you for this conversation.
QSL, Roy, thank you very much. It's very nice chatting up and being a part of the TechNet. 783 for now, KG2RY.
Very good, 73, David. And now it is, I want to, before I go, just thanks everyone for their participation tonight. I enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you'll join me next week when we do this all over again. But now is time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
Right, AC-WSN for the report for the TechNet. And I like Dave's story about the guitar with the humidity. Very interesting. There's a couple of topics I have. One in particular is the Talon A2. This plane is a, if you want to call it a plane, it's rocket powered. It got up to a Mach 5, so it's a hypersonic vehicle. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk by other countries going hypersonic. Well, this thing here is now capable of doing that. Hypersonic is anything 5 times the speed of sound or greater. So, you know, this thing's getting up to close to 4,000 miles per hour. The difference is now this country has got a company called Stratolaunch. Stratolaunch has developed the Talon, which drops from the carrier vehicle. The carrier vehicle is the Stratolaunch vehicle. Stratolaunch has got these two, it looks like two planes, you know, bolted together. It's got six jet engines. It's got these are 747 engines that Stratolaunch uses. This was developed years ago by Paul Allen, and soon after he died, this thing was tested and finally got off the ground years ago. But now they're doing regular flights, and it's a carrier plane. The wingspan is the largest wingspan in the world. It's over a football field length, over 300 feet long. But you know, right now they're bringing the Talon vehicle, also made by Stratolaunch, up to height. You know, they'll bring it up to 50,000 feet, and they'll drop it. And then the Talon has a they call it a Hadley jet powered engine. Runs on liquid kerosene, liquid oxygen. But it's a 5,000 pound thrust engine. Doesn't sound like much, but this vehicle, it's really only about 30 feet long. I think it's 28 feet long. It weighs around 6,000 pounds. Now, you're already up to altitude when the thing is dropped from the carrier vehicle. The rocket engine comes on and off it goes. The reason I bring this up about a week or so ago, it flew on its second flight. And the reason I think it's important that, you know, we have something like this is because it's now reusable. You know, first reusable vehicle since the X-15 to be able to go a hypersonic speed. Now, you can't put a person in this thing yet, but... right now they're looking to use it for research, and they want to know if thing flies, you know, accurately, which it does, and then actually bring it back autonomously to a runway. In this case, it was the runway out in Vandenberg Air Force Base. So interesting. You know, vehicle that Stratolaunch has built. So now, you know, it came back, landed on the runway, and they actually had a payload in there. They turned the payload over to whatever they were dealing with, and they'll be able to make these flights on a regular basis once they, you know, get these things going. The first flight was, you know, a few months ago, and this was the second flight. So it's now, you know, a complete reusable hypersonic vehicle. That got up to 104,000 feet, which is really great height. I was just trying to figure out if it had any reaction control jets on it in case it, you know, gets to the point where the air is so thin that they, you know, maybe it won't be able to control it. The X-15 had that capability. And for people that don't know what the X-15 was, that flew 199 flights back in the 60s. Famous people actually flew it, including Neil Armstrong. Any comments? WS-20. Anyway, I'm looking forward to but you got to see this carrier. If you haven't seen it, you bring up the Strato Launcher, and they have countless pictures of this thing, YouTube. It's really quite something. It was originally designed to carry spacecraft. They planned on dropping the Falcon 9, one of the earlier versions of it, but that all crashed. But they had plans on maybe putting a two-person crew on one of these vehicles, send them in space and into orbit. But that was all original plans, and as time went on, they decided to go with the defense payroll of the government. NASA's not paying for this. This comes out of the defense money. If they could use these hypersonic vehicles, for the military. Let me drop it. We'll move on. Yeah, okay. There's been a lot of talk about cancellations of different programs. And if you read the internet, if you go to these websites that, there's countless websites that are not reputable. And they make claims that the Dragonfly mission has been canceled. And so far it has not been canceled. And I don't think it will be. Dragonfly is the mission that will fly to Titan out in Saturn. We talked about this many times on the net. But Dragonfly will be launched on a SpaceX heavy vehicle. So it's really three Falcon 9 bolted together. We'll launch Dragonfly on the way to go to Saturn. And that won't happen until 2028. It'll take quite a few years to get there. I think they're looking at 2034 or something like that. Actually, going into orbit around Saturn and then having this vehicle separate from that mothership and head down to the planet. And it's still questionable on whether or not they're going to have an orbital vehicle. It'll probably not be. I'm going to guess they'll probably just use that as an expendable vehicle. But Dragonfly will come flying through the atmosphere of Titan, one of the moons. By the way, we talked about how many moons Saturn had about a week or two ago, Charlie, and latest was 102 or something like that. That now turns out there's 220 some odd moons going around Saturn. But one of the big ones, of course, is Titan. And the idea is to send Dragonfly down to that planet. It will be in the atmosphere with a heat shield. And that will slow it down to the point they'll probably use a parachute after that, slow it down even more. But then as it comes closer to the surface of Titan, the heat shield will drop away, and that will expose the vehicle inside the aero shell, the top part of the descent vehicle. And I believe they'll probably use some kind of a pushing mechanism to separate it from the aero shell. I haven't seen how they're going to do that yet. Mars rovers, the two big ones, the Curiosity and Perseverance came down that way, and they used cables to separate from the aeroshell and set up. But once this thing is free of anything, it's got eight rotators on it, all electric motors. It's essentially a gigantic drone. This thing is going to weigh, you know, over 1,000 pounds. So it'll be in a free flight at that point, and naturally, however, it's on board. It'll figure out where it wants to land, similar to types of cameras that they use now on the moon, where, you know, they can figure out where it's going to be safe. And, you know, it'll come down and land, and then at that point they'd be able to start doing science, real science with the dragonfly. And now if that area is complete, they get all the data they want, they'll be able to turn these blades back on again, eight of them, and the drone will take off and they can fly to another location. I read that they'll be able to fly like 5 minutes at a time. So they'll be able to go to another area that's maybe 5 minutes away, and land and do the same thing. And they have the capability of recharging the batteries. Of course, it's too far away for solar power. So they'll use their RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, will be on board, which will be constantly charging these lithium-ion batteries. So now, let's say it settles down on the moon and those batteries need to be recharged, it'll just, stop and won't be doing any science for a while. Batteries will recharge, and when they're up and running, they'll be able to continue on with their science and even fly to a different location. Anyways, WS2N, does anybody have any comments about Dragonfly? Okay, nothing heard. We'll see how that goes. We've got quite a few years, and I'm going to make sure I don't pay attention to these websites and YouTubes, which, by the way, I'm not a YouTube fan. everybody loves the YouTube, but I don't know, I'd just rather read the articles and move on without countless commercials. That doesn't interest me at all. Even when I watch TV, I record everything, and I sit there with the remote. I will not sit there and watch commercials. And if you watch an hour TV show and you have 15 or 20 minutes of commercials, that adds up. You got countless hours of your life thrown away on commercials, and now they're doing that with YouTube. I don't like that. Unless it's important, there's no question about it. You're going to learn something, but I'm not going to just click on anything to watch. Now, here's another rumor that they keep talking about. The sample return mission is supposed to be happening on Mars. They say, Trump's going to cancel it. No, he'd probably like to cancel it, but these websites are saying it's canceled. It's not canceled, as far as NASA's concerned. They're going full steam ahead right now. It might be in the future. But and that involves, other foreign countries. We're involved with European nations with the sample return mission. We're going to go up there maybe with a rocket that's built by America. Northrop Grumman's supposed to be involved with that. Imagine this rocket lands on Mars, and a rover comes out couple of helicopters come out, and they pick up the 30-some-odd test tubes that were laying around on Martian surface as we speak now. Pick them up, bring them back to the Northrop Grumman solid fuel rocket, put the samples in it, and now they launch it into orbit around Mars. You know, it's such an expensive project that European Space Agency is involved with this. They're going to launch their own rocket, probably from a French Guiana on the Ariane 6 rocket. And a large spacecraft to start orbiting Mars that has the capability of flying back to Earth. So here comes this Northrop Grumman solid fuel rocket launched from the surface of Mars with the 30 tubes that it just picked up. And it will dock with this vehicle from European Space Agency. At that point, it will transfer the 30 test tube samples into the European Space Agency return vehicle. That will have these very large engines to get out of orbit around Mars and start heading back to Earth. And that, you know, when it eventually comes back to Earth, sample return test tubes will now be put inside of a descent vehicle to come through the Earth's atmosphere. Again, not by the United States, but by foreign countries. Comes through the atmosphere, lands in the Utah Proving Ground to be picked up by Americans. At that point, scientists will love it. They'll get these samples back, and they'll be able to finally figure out if these samples contain evidence of past life. So there you go. That's the reason that this thing, I don't see ever being canceled. You have countless states that are involved with different aspects of this mission. You have European countries also involved. You know, they've got like $10 billion that are going to be invested in a sample return mission. Who knows how many billion dollars they've already spent. They decide to cancel it. What do they do? They go write all that money that's been spent. You gonna write that off? I don't think so. Any comments? WS2N.
WB2BS. So.
B2BXO. Hi, Frank. Was my voice anyway. Not good. Anyway, back to you, Frank.
Yeah, very good. I guess what I could envision is Nib doing to Weizmann, if the guy ever gets confirmed, is insisting that to continue the program, that the foreign partners throw in more money. That seems to be the way he operates. I think you're right. Even though the inclination would be to cancel everything that doesn't produce a spectacular TV show of a crew landing on a planet or the moon, it's possible that some of these programs will continue by just insisting that foreign partners throw in more money to it.
You know, I just don't see this program being canceled. You know, some of the other ones, you know, the climate ones, I could see that, you know. But when so many people are involved, and different countries are involved, I don't see that as a possibility. Even years ago, I remember when the Bush administration got into office, they didn't want the climate types of things either, so... There was something called Triana. It was built, ready to go. It's going to be launched to the L L1 position, and it was going to, one of the goals was actually to look back at Earth 24 hours a day, you know, from a million miles away, and be able to take pictures of Earth, you know, the whole Earth in one shot, you know, which was really unusual back then, in the Bush days. That would have been great. So that was canceled. But they don't throw these things away. It was already built. They, you know, put it in mothballs and stored it away for a whole bunch of years until eventually in the early 2000, I think. Now a little late, later. Probably 2000 and... I think it was 2008. Anyway, they said, let's bring back Triana. And they did. But they just changed the name to Discover. And they added a few more instruments on board. Good time went by, and they were able to do that. And sure enough, it's, you know, to this day, sitting out at the L1 position, a million miles away, doing what Triana was supposed to do. So, we'll see. Back over to you, Frank. And, you know, by the way, I'm paying attention to whatever Starship number 9 takes off. And now they're talking about, oh, another week or so, but I, you know, I've been hearing that for months. But we'll see. I think they're having problems. They're working out, trying to figure out what happened to the last two flights. And from what I'm reading, it's not 100% sure of what really happened. But, you know, they're doing everything, they're beefing everything up. So we'll see if Starship is able to get off the ground and make it to the Indian Ocean like it's supposed to. Back to you, Brian. Next go around, might have a glitch over there. The Roman Space Telescope, another rumored story of being canceled. This thing is scheduled to fly very shortly. You know, it's got a 2,500 little micro lens detection things that are on it. It's going to be able to look at the whole sky with the clarity of the Hubble Space Telescope, except in large swaths, like 100 times the area that Hubble could do. So we'll skip this round too. But, you know, again, they're saying that thing is supposed to be canceled. Roman Telescope what happened was, when the Hubble was built, you know, NASA believed in redundancy, and they were going to make this gigantic mirror for Hubble. They said, well, we'll make another one, too, you know, we might eventually need a second one. Of course, it was never used again. That went into storage for decades. But now, that was actually owned by National Reconnaissance Office. They were going to use this Hubble-like telescope, look down at Earth, and, you know, spy on everybody that way. But that never happened. So they had this big mirror. Sure enough, they turned it over to NASA, and NASA for years now has been building it up to become the Roman Space Telescope. So again, this thing has got too much of a past to be canceled. Again, if they use the word cancel, I will change the word. Brighter minds come around and decide to relaunch these things. Any further comments? And maybe Frank is back. WS2N.
Yeah, I do apologize. I was looking at something else, leaned over to pick up the phone, and of course hit the disconnect button. Anyway, my impression with some of the videos, which as you say correctly may not be that reliable, was stage two Starship itself had been tested to failure on the engine, so they might have a pretty good idea of what the failure was and where the resonances that were causing the problem are, and what they appear to have decided to do is to not do catches on either stage, to dump them both into the ocean, to concentrate on getting the trajectory right and see if they could get the newer version of the Block 2 Starship with, Block 3 engines fly the full trajectory into the Indian Ocean. So we'll see if they really try to launch this week. You know, it's not like NASA where they hold a news conference every day and tell you what they're doing. It's, everything's proprietary and they can do what they want unless it suits their marketing needs. I'm not telling you, obviously, anything you don't know. WB2BX, so.
Okay, Frank, yeah, very good. Yeah, well, we'll see. I always like the idea that, you know, when NASA's doing something, we get 99% of what's going on, you know, makes it to the media. Private companies don't have to do that. A couple of them are pretty good. You know, Peter Beck with Rocket Lab, he's pretty good. But, you know, I mean, they could all back off if they wanted to. One of the downsides of private companies. You take Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin. He's pretty upfront about some of the stuff, but he's kept everything quiet for a long time. But lately, he's talking more and more about what's really going on. What he hasn't released yet, I still haven't seen an actual picture of the Kuiper satellites that are going to be used for the broadband system that eventually with 3,100 is the satellite
time complete
to orbit. He has kept that a secret. I've seen on Earth reports, but I think once they're working, which should be shortly, maybe if he gets another launch or two up there. He's already got now 27 up there because of the one launch. They say that at that point, they'll release the information about what things look like, their capabilities, how are they different than other constellations for the same. We'll have to wait and see. Anyway, it's getting late, so I just want to mention that India tried to get launch. It's a SAR, a synthetic aperture radio system from India, and it was one of theirs. Dr. Roy a message, and I mixed up the two of the launch providers. Electron, which had a Japanese launch, and India. India didn't launch the Japanese satellite. India launched its own satellite. Anyway, they have this four-stage rocket. It's called the Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle. They have two main rockets that they use, the third, but the two main rockets that India uses, the PSLV, Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle, and then they have the GSLV, the geosynchronous.